Pixar, THX, Star Wars, ILM, Lucasfilm, Indiana Jones. Today on Sci-Fi Idols, let's talk about George Lucas, shall we? A successful 1967 Broadway revival, and with their option to produce a film based on it soon expiring, Warner Brothers was anxious to quickly mount a film version of the musical Finian's Rainbow, even if it meant putting that hippie upstart kid Francis Ford Coppola in the director's chair. And so they did. During filming, Coppola noticed a thin, bearded kid watching him work. He was told that the young man had won a film school award, and part of his reward was to come and watch a feature film shoot. The young man, one George Lucas, chose Finian's Rainbow as Coppola was at the vanguard of a wave of film school directors who would go on to subvert the old men's club of the film industry, gaining a director's seat on film projects based on their talent and merit, and skipping the "it's who you know" part. At USC, where Lucas had won the award for his short Electronic Labyrinth THX-1138-4EB, Coppola was seen as proof that the industry could be changed, and it was happening. And it was happening now. Everything was now in the 60s. And George Walton Lucas Jr. planned to join this new world of auteur-driven filmmaking, this group who Scorsese, Coppola, Kubrick, Milius, De Palma, would soon be known as the New Hollywood. Little did he know, standing on that soundstage in 1967, that he was about to make a lifelong friend in Francis Coppola, and that he, Francis, would in turn help George's award-winning short turn into a full-length film, THX-1138. But before that, George had an interesting trip to Altamont ahead of him. David and Albert Maysles were shooting a concert film of the Rolling Stones, and George got a job as a camera operator for the Altamont shoot. The film, Gimme Shelter, would become notorious not merely for the Stones' usual energetic live show, but because of the strange turn of events in Altamont. Unbelievably, the Hells Angels had been hired as security for the show, and when 18-year-old Meredith Hunter pulled a gun in the crowd, he was stabbed to death by one of those Hell's Angels, on camera. The incident immediately changed the film's focus from a simple concert film to something else entirely. In a weird way, George was otherwise left out of the spectacle, as A, he was just a camera operator at the time, and B, the camera he was running shot only about 100 feet of film before jamming and not being useful for the rest of the shoot. None of George's footage was used in the final film. George believed that there was really something to the student films of the time. We all feel that way when we're in the middle of something that's real and engaging and exciting to us, but that no one can see. If only they'd look, they'd just see, we feel. But this was at the end of the big Hollywood machine era. The big studio moguls were old men now, and it was the 60s, and holy crap, look out world, because George was right.
I think the student films are the only real hope. I think they're slowly beginning to realize that students know what they're doing. You know, that they're not just a bunch of silly kids out there, playing around.
The old system was about to suffer an invasion of film school auteurs who would change the landscape of film in the 70s and on. George had in mind art films, tone poems, and any number of student ideas. But first he'd get a chance at taking THX-1138 to the big screen. And that would set him on a path that would lead him to build an empire around a set of films about an empire. Coppola dreamed of building a filmmaker's and director's utopia, a place where the visionary could come and pour their ideas onto the screen, and he, force of nature that he was at the time, would get them out to the world to appreciate. This was the genesis of the much more down-to-earth Zoetrope Studios, and in 1971, Zoetrope helped Lucas realize a big screen version of his student short, THX-1138. little knowing that Lucas would soon go on to build a utopia of filmmaking of his own that would dwarf Zoetrope and take in billions. THX was the new cinema scene's first real glimpse at the love of sci-fi and adventure that lived inside George Lucas. Something that went back to his boyhood watching Buck Rogers and Adventure Theater at a friend's house, at least until his own father finally relented and bought a television set. But soon after THX 1138, the entire world would know the extent of that love very, very well. But first, there was one more stop on the road to his fortune, with the top down on a warm summer night. Something Lucas also loved was cars. You've surely heard this before, and as a teen he spent many hours working on and improving his little Fiat Bianchina, so he could spend more hours cruising the streets of Modesto, hanging out at the round table with the other kids. George loved cars and took to racing like a duck to water. He said his father, with whom he had a strained relationship, assumed he would become a mechanic and never amount to much, but George's love of cars and his memories of cruising would make his 1973 film American Graffiti into a money machine. Made for just under $800,000, it's gone on to become one of the most profitable films in history, taking in over $21 million within a few months, a total of $55 million worldwide. The funny bit is that American Graffiti was kind of written on a dare. Coppola challenged Lucas to write a mainstream film, and so he did. And it made boatloads of money after a brief sleeper period. It was re-released in 1978 and did an additional $63 million. Think of that, 5 years later, and this under $1 million movie about teenagers and cars has made the studio over $117 million. And this is in 1970s money. By the way, if you're wondering whether Happy Days was an American Graffiti ripoff, the answer is no. Both were conceived during a period when 50s nostalgia was high. Happy Days, with Ron Howard in the cast, had already been shot as a pilot called New Family in Town and hadn't been picked up. During pre-production of American Graffiti, Lucas asked to view the pilot as he was thinking of casting Howard. He did, it was a hit, and Happy Days was greenlit as a regular season, a happy turn of events for all involved. After the success of Graffiti, Lucas had the money to create his own production company, buy a house, and sit down and write a film for himself, for the kid who still very much lived in George Lucas. And despite his success, he'd still have a hard time selling the idea to the studios who, while changed, were still, well, Hollywood. It took lots of wrangling and lawyering, and yes, many things changed as time went on, but finally, in 1977, Star Wars premiered. And nothing has been quite the same since. And I don't even need to describe it all to you over again. You know the story very well. Now one of the most successful of the new Hollywood bunch, George Lucas is a name known around the world. The Star Wars franchise is undoubtedly the most profitable of its kind in the history of cinema. Seriously, think about it. And think about this. In less than 10 years, that skinny kid on the set of Finian's Rainbow changed the face of sci-fi cinema forever. Oh, and possibly saved 20th Century Fox while doing it. Having been raised by Kubrick's intense 2001 A Space Odyssey, the bar was now, again, set even higher by Star Wars and its sequels. Other studios rushed to imitate it, and few succeeded. How it came to be that car-loving, tone-poem, avant-garde, student filmmaker George becomes Star Wars George is kind of hard to piece together unless you're in Lucas's head, but there it is. He built the Skywalker Empire that took in billions and billions in revenue over the ensuing years, and still to this day thrills new audiences with the Star Wars films, the Clone Wars series, toys, books, apparel, comics, you name it. Seemingly out of nowhere, he impressed the entire world, even his dad. George Lucas, a true sci-fi idol. This has been Sci-Fi Idols with your host Maggie McPhee. You can find us online at sci-fiidols.com. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod.